Water is essential to life, but also agriculture, industry, and energy. It is the foundation of modern civilization, but ever-rising consumption and climate change have many worried there won't be enough to go around. Meanwhile, sea level rise and extreme weather threaten some areas with disaster. How can we avoid conflict and build peace? How can we ensure everyone has what they need to survive and thrive as we march toward a global population of more than 9 billion? You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Environmental Change and Security Program at the Wilson Center. In this special series, Water Stories, we interview experts and practitioners from around the world to hear how people are thinking about and addressing water security challenges. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, we'll hear from Gordon Mumbo, the team leader for USAID's Sustainable Water Partnership in the Mara River Basin. Gordon recently traveled from his home in Kenya to D.C., where he spoke at a Wilson Center event co-sponsored by Winrock International and the Sustainable Water Partnership. We were able to catch him on the edges of that event to hear more about his work in the Mara River Basin and the lessons he's learned in his 30 years of water resource management. So, Gordon, what brings you to town?
Yeah, I'm in town to participate in a pause and reflect of Sustainable Water Partnership, a project that has bring all the global activities in the Mara, in Cambodia, South Africa, and Nepal. So we are convening here at Winrock headquarters just to reflect on what has worked well and what has not worked, and how do we move forward as we move towards the end of this activity.
Can you tell us a little bit about the Sustainable Water Partnership?
A Sustainable Water Partnership is an initiative supported by USAID that is supporting countries on how best they can manage their water resources and secure the security of it. It's also a learning process to USAID on how they can support countries moving forward in water resources management.
So tell us about your experience of working in the Mara River Basin under the Sustainable Water Partnership.
It has been exciting. You know, if you live in the developed world or in some urban centers, then the supply of water is guaranteed. You wake up and all the time you expect there will be water flowing in your tap. If you don't find it flowing, you get upset and probably will call the utility companies. But if you're in the Mara Basin, people don't have that luxury. They have to walk to the river to get water and bring it home. So what we are doing is to ensure that the river continues to flow and meets the needs of people, water needs of people. Not only people, because if you look at the ecological setup in the Mara Basin, we have human beings and we have some of the most interesting wildlife in the world, who are so significant to both Kenya and Tanzania in terms of revenue generation. The tourist industry in the Mara Basin is quite significant to Kenya and Tanzania. And the mainstay of the wildlife in the Mara Basin is really the wildlife. That's why, because compared to other rivers in the basin, Mara is relatively a small river. But because of its ecological system where the wildlife and the economic benefits it brings to Kenya, to Tanzania, it becomes a very important river. So what we've been doing there is to get to understanding. In the past, there have been a lot of destruction in terms of the catchment areas, and this is resulting into reduced flow in the river. So what we are trying to understand is to get an understanding on how much water is available and how much water is needed, trying to get a balance between supply and demand and identification of the gaps. And once we know that, then it puts us into a better position to manage the river better during times of scarcity and during times of plenty. And during scarcity, there need to be prudent ways of using water. In that aspect, we are working with Kenya and Tanzania to get water in the technical terms you would call the water location plan. Water location plan is nothing but just getting an understanding on how much water you need to flow in the river to sustain the environmental or ecology of the river. And then what do you need for human beings? Then the excess is what you can use for production in terms of agriculture and the rest. But in the matter, you don't stop at considering human beings only. You also consider the wildlife. So we are looking at how much water we need to sustain the environment, the people, and the wildlife. The excess is what could be used for other productive means. We are also looking into what has caused the degradation in the Mara River Basin. And most of the degradation has resulted from human activities. The rising population means there's demand for more food. So people are clearing what used to be catchment areas to produce food, and this is resulting into a drying up of some of the springs that supply water to the river. So we are working backwards with the communities and the governments and trying to restore, put in place. We are looking at areas of reforestation, where we are planting trees in places that have been destroyed. And we are also looking at alternative livelihoods. Why do people? We went deep to understand why people do those destructive activities. And it's more linked to livelihoods. So we are working at the lowest level, at grassroots level, with communities and putting into place alternative livelihood means that do not result into destruction of catchment areas. And one element that has become, we never knew, but has become so important is in the beekeeping. So to get engaged in the beekeeping, we looked at the demand for honey in the world, and is high. I think Kenya alone needs close to 45 tons of honey.
Wow.
But the production is around 5. So the gap is huge. So, and the one important thing that bees do is they do the pollination that ensure that trees will always be there, and pollination of other crops that people depend on for food. At the same time, they provide the honey. So one would not want to cut down a tree where beehives are kept. We are also looking at how best can people access quality water. There are a lot of springs along the basin, and we are trying to develop the springs to supply people with more safe water for domestic use. The other aspect that springs do provide, they help in recharging the river. During the dry season, you'll find the excess flow from the springs drain into the river, and that increases the flow.
Can you, so you talked about the beekeeping as an alternative livelihood strategy. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like in terms of introducing it to a community as an alternative approach to securing their livelihoods?
Yes, the approach we are using is quite unique. What we are doing is training people on beekeeping and how to set up beehives and how to keep your beehives in good condition. Quality of honey, how to harvest good quality honey, because the buyers need quality honey. And what we are doing is we put in communities together and who want to keep bees for honey, and establishing honey collection centers within the communities which are managed by themselves. So if you are a farmer that does beekeeping, you will harvest your honey and take it to the collection center. And the collection center is where quality control is done, where they assess the quality of your honey, and you get payment based on your honey. The collection center is also going to help the communities in marketing their honey.
Mm-hmm.
So as a farmer, you don't have to struggle with marketing your honey. You take it to the collection center, which is managed by a committee elected by communities themselves, and they're the ones who now deal with marketing of the honey. So if you get into beekeeping, then you are guaranteed of market as long as your quality of your honey is good. At the moment, the communities that we are working with are actually exporting honey to the Arab world.
Really?
The demand is so high, they need like 20 tons per week.
Wow.
But so far, the supply is dwindling. It's not even a ton.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. In today's event, you talked about working with the local hotels in the Mara River Basin as sort of an example of private sector engagement in securing water in the area. Can you tell us a little bit about what that experience has been like?
That experience, actually, when we started, the biggest challenge was lack of a platform that brought the hoteliers together. And they expressed a need to bring the platform because the way they are investing individually was not going to be significant. So that led us to support the registration of Mara Hoteliers Association.
Okay.
This association has now been registered, so they will be establishing bank account. And through their corporate social responsibilities, they will be investing money into the platform. And the money invested in the platform will go into conservation work of the Mara. Because really, their business depend on water being available in the Mara.
And they understood that from the outset.
They understood that from the outset, that their business depends on water being available in the river. For the use in the hotel industries and also to sustain the lives of the wildlife that live there. So with the establishment of this platform, we see there's going to be good engagement of the hoteliers into support the conservation of the Mara River Basin. I think one element that we need to be understood is the government is not a consumer. The government is not a producer. Mm-hmm. The government is a consumer. So the private sector must take lead when it comes to areas of production.
Okay.
And the private sector has more efficient ways of producing, especially if you get into the element of food production.
Mm-hmm.
The private sector would maximize whatever is available to get good food production in the smallest area of agriculture. So with that understanding that the government is a consumer, it's not a producer, what the government needs to do is to set enabling environment that can attract investment from private investors. In addition to that, public participation is critical in terms of public understanding the intentions of the investors and what they want to do and involving them in the process. I think those are some of the lessons that we are learning.
You say that the government needs to sort of create an enabling environment. Can you talk about what that might look like?
Yes, the government need to enabling environment would involve friendly policy environments, regulatory mm-hmm. systems, and control of competition, how competition is controlled and managed, information sharing with the public, that should be some of the environment setting, access to financing. There are places where governments will need to give guarantees to private investors. Because sometimes access to finances becomes a problem. And private investors also want to be guaranteed that they will be able to recoup back their investment. And when they go for loans, the governments should be ready to provide that guarantee when it's needed. So the enabling environment is about policies, control, information sharing, and access to financing facilities.
You mentioned that you're here in town with your colleagues to sort of take stock on the Sustainable Water Partnership and the lessons learned. I wonder if you could share some of those lessons with us here.
Yes, I think one of the greatest lessons, particularly from the Mara Basin, that we are understanding is public participation of stakeholders in water conservation is critical. You must be able to share the data freely with the stakeholders for them to understand, especially if they understand how much water is available in the river system at a given time and why sometimes the water managers tell them to stop irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
That data need to be shared and disseminated and communicated properly. The other lesson that we are learning, don't design interventions in isolation. Get all stakeholders involved in the process, communities, the private sector, and the government. and come up with agreeable interventions. For instance, when we started the Mara project, we spent close to 2 days with stakeholders just looking at the interventions in the project design and getting the right options from the stakeholders. And that has really helped because that gave us a buy-in from day one. So right. All that we do tend to get government support. The other lesson that we are learning is limited data on river basins. Especially if you want to do historical data, that data is sometimes difficult to get.
Yeah.
And if it's available, it's not within the closed centers. You might get it from other institutions that are involved in water management. And if sometimes it's not even accurate. So predicting the future becomes frustrating, especially if you do not have good historical background. The other lesson that we are learning is climate vulnerability. At grassroots level, people don't understand when we talk of climate change, it's a strange word to them. But demystifying this to come down, because if you talk to people, you ask them, how has the rain pattern been in the past? They will easily tell you.
Right.
And then as maybe a technical person, you can link that to climate change. So the ability of the technical practitioners to be able to demystify some of the terminologies for users to understand is really helpful. Because if you ask people, you talk to people about hotspots, they don't understand what you mean by hotspots.
Right.
But if you demystify that and tell them in this context, this is what the hotspot means, and then be useful and give you very useful intervention. Political goodwill is also important because at the end of the day, the politicians make the decision. So you also need to get a buy-in from the politicians on your interventions for them to be accepted. Yeah, these are some of the lessons that we are learning.
These are great lessons.
Yeah.
You've had a pretty fascinating career path. I wonder if you could just take a few minutes and tell us about what got you to where you are today.
Oh, interesting. It has been a long journey. Actually, growing up, I thought the best career for me was to be a lawyer.
Oh, really?
But one day I was chatting with my dad and he told me, think about it again if you really want to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I grew up in a river basin, the River Nyando, and I saw how devastating it used to be during floods, how it floods and destroys people things. And then I started getting interest into water.
Okay.
And in school, you were learning geography about the Dutch, how they reclaimed their land from water because Dutch land is below sea level. And that made me develop interest into learning water. So I decided to become a water engineer, and I pursued that. And the interesting part became now into the management of the resource. I spent most of my time working career life, which is still going on water supply and sanitation.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized that you cannot, unless the source is sustained, even getting water to supply to people would be a problem. And I developed interest in now the resource side of things. And after my college work, I did a degree in water engineering and also master's in water engineering technology. But later on, went to the Philippines and did development management. And I was now thinking on how do I apply this in the context of water management. And I was lucky I worked for NGOs in Africa, CARE International, Plan International, and WaterAid, where I worked for in East Africa and West Africa, and finally to the UK. And then while I was at the UK, I got the opportunity to go and work in the Nile Basin under UN employment. And that gave me more energy now to start thinking more of water resources management. After that, I worked for Water for People, which is a U.S.-based organization in Colorado. So I used to stay in Colorado a few days and in Africa for a few days. Eventually, I was moved.
Quite a commute.
Quite a commute. Eventually, I was moved to Nairobi. So when the option came that I should come back to the U.S., I said, it's interesting to be here.
Okay, yeah.
And then I was lucky to be hired by Sustainable Water Partnership as the team leader for the Mara River Water Resources. That has been the long journey, but my main interest has been into how do we conserve the resource for people to get access to clean water. Because if you work on the other side of the supply, the abstractors just want to get water. Because if you talk to a utility company, they are interested in getting as much water as they can. But investing into sustaining that resource becomes a little bit difficult for them. So I think working on the resource side of things gives me a lot of excitement, because you are guaranteed that water will always be there for people and for other productive means. The floods around my place has now been reduced as through construction of dikes. But we are also learning something about that. In any intervention that you design, you should also look into the social impacts of it. Because during the dike construction, I don't think the social impact assessment was properly done, because the floods were capital to people. It floods, it brings fish, people get fish, it floods. After that, you can easily do cultivation for crops that are short-lived and get food. That is not there, so that has also been lost. So what interests me is constant engagement with the people, especially when it comes to water resources management. I believe that the river belongs to the people. The people who live along the river understand the river better than you, and they can give you a cleaner history of the river, and if you want to restore it back to its original state, it's them who will advise you. So going down, and I normally think that development workers should unlearn when they go to the communities and then relearn with the people. And that is when you can design good interventions. That is the opportunity that working in water resources conservation gives me, interacting with the people and getting the right interventions that you can now translate into more scientific terms as a technical person.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, Gordon.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.